And I remember stepping into the shot, I just had this thought, like appear out of nowhere, don't shank it. Tried to deploy my toolbox, and actually just that thought just got louder and louder. Mm. I'm pretty sure that my eyes were closed in the downswing, because that thought was just like, shank, like this in my downswing. And I flushed it. Like, I absolutely flushed it. It wasn't actually until after my playing days had finished that I heard about ACT. And I remember, you know, opening a textbook, and I was just like, that's it. I was like, this is it. This is why that moment then made sense.
Hello and welcome back to Golf Yourself Happy. This is the podcast for everyday golfers who love the game but don't always love how it makes them feel. My name is Chris Lynch. I'm the head coach here at Golf Yourself Happy. And if you're new here, a warm welcome to you. You have joined us at a really exciting time. At the core of Golf Yourself Happy is this idea that golf should add to your life and not drain it, and that enjoyment of the game shouldn't be conditional on how well you play, and that there's a space in this game for all of us, not just the elite. If that resonates with you, then I need you to know about Happy Hackers. It's a free WhatsApp community I have launched for golfers like you and me, people who love the game but want to experience it differently. With no pressure, no egos, no unsolicited advice, just a space to share the ups, the downs, and everything else in between. You can join us via the link in the show notes. The game is hard enough, let's face it, so you don't have to do it alone. Get yourself into the community, and I look forward to seeing you there. Now, to introduce today's guest. It's going to be a really special one, this episode, with our guest Trevor Jones, a PGA professional and mental performance coach who works with golfers across all levels of the game. Trevor, or Trev, as he likes to be known, has spent the last decade exploring the psychological side of performance, and in particular, a model called Acceptance and Commitment Training, or ACT. Now, those of you who regularly listen, or those of you who missed it a few episodes back, you'll remember that I introduced the HAPPY framework. And that framework that I have built has acceptance and commitment training at the very heart of it. That is in the engine room to the HAPPY framework. And so it was a no-brainer, quite frankly, for me to seek out Trev and ask him to be a guest, given his background and experience in this subject. In the conversation, we explore lots of things, including why trying to control your thoughts and emotions on the golf course often makes things worse, what mental toughness actually looks like and why it might not be what you think it is, and also how you can start to build a healthier, more sustainable relationship with the game. Yes, it's a conversation about performance on the one hand, but most importantly, in my view, it's a conversation about experience, the experience of playing golf. So, without any further ado, here is my conversation with Trev Jones. Hope you enjoy it. Well, Trev, thanks very much for agreeing to come on the podcast. Thanks for having me here. This is where the magic happens, I think, as they say in MTV Cribs, right? So tell us about the setup that you got here.
Yeah, happens sometimes. Chris, it's wonderful to have you. Yeah, really excited about what you're doing with this podcast and looking forward to this conversation. And yeah, this is a place where I suppose I've kind of dreamed of, you know, this, the bunker, as it's now called, dreamed of this for probably over a decade. And, you know, saving and moving house and, you know, things coming together and, you know, the right friends at the right time, and managed to build this place. And this is now very much home for me in terms of having clients, both in a psychological capacity and also sometimes in a physical capacity. There have been a few people who have sat in the seat you're sat in now, that have ventured across the globe to come and see me, which has been a real thrill.
That's fantastic. To ACT, it's ultimately the reason in particular I sought you out and wanted to have a conversation with you. And do you want to say a brief word on how you first came across it? What made you so sure and have a conviction that there's something with this model that golf and golfers need?
In the strangest way, I think I experienced ACT before I knew about ACT. So just to take you back a little ways, if that's okay.
Please do, yeah. Feel free.
So I'm on the 18th hole, the final hole, the 54th hole. It was a 54-hole championship. So I'm on the 54th hole of the Welsh National Championship, right? Cardiff Golf Club. Absolutely sopping wet. You know, it'd been peeing down all week. It was October in Cardiff. And
sounds like Wales to me.
Yeah, there we go. And I was there with a 2-shot lead, and I hadn't been in anything like that kind of experience. Of course, I'd won tournaments as an amateur, but nothing of that kind of prestige. And there's several hundred people around the green, and I remember kind of stepping in. I had 2-shot lead, par 3, 18th hole, and I remember stepping into the shot, and I just had this. I was like about to pull the trigger, and I just had this thought, like appear out of nowhere. Don't shank it. And I'm just like, say what now? You know, I'm like, it's kind of like...
And had that type of intrusive thought ever happened upon you before? No.
I'd never had that one. Never had...
So that was highly unusual.
Highly unusual. Yeah. So it kind of like wobbled me a bit, right? And I remember backing off and, you know, I was performing at a decent level at the time. I hadn't been in that type of position in you know, such a big event. But I'd done, you know, a fair amount of reading around more traditional sports psychology. You know, I had a bit of a toolbox there, if you like. And I stood back and I delved into the toolbox and I tried to apply a few things. And actually just that thought became louder, right? And this was not a hole that you could shank it on. You know, shanking the ball on that hole would be dead, basically. So yeah, I tried to deploy my toolbox, and actually just that thought just got louder and louder. Mm. And I remember standing over the ball, and I'm pretty sure that my eyes were closed in the downswing, because that thought was just like, shank, like this in my downswing. And I flushed it. Like, I absolutely flushed it. You know, I kind of like, in the follow through, open my eyes, I'm like, where is it? And the ball's like raining down on the pin. You know, pitched about 10 feet short, spun back. It was that well struck. And I was like kind of checking, like, am I here? What's happened? What's the, you know, my playing partner's like,
yeah,
you're
right, dude. When am I going to wake up from this? Yeah.
And I ended up two putting and winning the championship. And I was driving home, and I'll never forget this. As I said, I think I'd experienced ACT before I knew about ACT. And I was driving home, and I remember the trophy was in the passenger seat. And I was like, what happened? Like, how did that happen? Like, I couldn't really make sense of it, because everything that I knew about psychology, sports psychology, high performance, like, told me that shouldn't happen, you know? To be able to perform at our best, it happens under these kind of ideal conditions, so to speak. So, you know, the right kind of thoughts, like the feelings of confidence, the feelings of assuredness are there. So there was a bit of a weird, like, the equation all of a sudden didn't make sense, right? And to be honest, I didn't know what to do with that. I didn't have a framework or a model that could then help me integrate that. So I actually doubled down on traditional sports psychology the next 2 years, playing full time, and I really struggled. Like, I really, really struggled. And
Is it fair to say, because I was going to ask you then, what was in your toolbox at that time? You were saying, was your toolbox made up of things from traditional?
It was.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there was a lot of visualization. There was a lot of goal setting. There was a lot of, you know, like, building my confidence through, you know, finishing a round. And then I would... you know, go back over the great shots I hit, the great feelings that I had, and this idea of, like, association. So I kept trying to kind of, like, anchor myself, anchor the feeling that I had of confidence to the moment, you know, that there was, like, hitting those good shots. So this idea of, you know, we're working through association, the mind works through association, almost like the mind is a computer. So if I just kind of pair that up enough, then in the moments that matter, hey presto, there it is. And it just turns out we're so much more complicated than that. And it wasn't actually until after my playing days had finished that I heard about ACT. And I remember, you know, opening a textbook and I was just like, that's it. I was like, this is it. This is why that moment then made sense. So that was, yeah, let's say 10 years ago. And I don't think I've come back out of that rabbit hole, you know, since then.
Well, it would seem that being down that rabbit hole is, you've unearthed lots of great things, and it's not a bad rabbit hole to go down. You know, as I said to you in preparation for this conversation, the intention here today is not necessarily to go really deep and sort of like theoretically explain things in huge detail with ACT. But I've got something written down here, which is around this idea of mental toughness. Now, you were talking just a second ago about before, the Trev of however many years ago in that moment would have relied upon visualization, goal setting, this or that. And you talk about that. There's a brilliant Instagram post that you put out recently, which is, I encourage all of my sort of viewers and listeners to check it out on, and I'll put the link to your Instagram in the show notes, but it's a lion chasing a zebra. Can you walk us through, can you almost paint that picture for us as to what the meaning of that was in terms of like, almost how we think of mental toughness, but actually maybe there's more to it than just meets the eye?
Well, I think one of the key questions there is, you know, how do we relate to uncertainty?
Yeah.
And very often, you know, given that, you know, part of the brain's job is to predict really what's going to happen next. So we are prediction machines, essentially. So, you know, if I said to you, Mary had a little...
Yeah.
You see what shows up. Blondes have more, right? So there's a looking back into your learning history.
Yeah.
And then there's a prediction about what's going to happen next. Mm-hmm. So when we're walking to the first tee, let's say, mm-hmm. just kind of catching that around, okay, so what are these predictions that are showing up in an effort essentially to reduce uncertainty? Okay, and so if I can just predict enough stuff, if I can get that certainty, if I can get that self-assuredness, you know, the world becomes more predictable, I can become more settled, I can feel more self-assured or confident, and then I can go and play my game, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. The problem with mental toughness is, or this idea of that, is one of the ways that we kind of guard ourselves against uncertainty is by armoring up. So we start to add a breastplate, we start to add the shoulder guards, we start to add the helmet. So it's that kind of those moves that we're making around, you know, reassuring ourselves, like, it will be fine, like, I can do this. What about the time I did this? Well, remember that great shot I hit? What about, and you get into this position where, a little bit like medieval knights, which is kind of what I spoke to in that post, you know, you end up feeling safer because you're wearing this huge suit of armor, but you're also becoming less effective, right? Because within that process, you know, you're becoming more and more rigid, right?
Heavier,
yeah. More and more rigid.
Weighed down by it.
Weighed down.
Yeah.
So there can be a lot of like mental gymnastics happening within that process. And what I was trying to speak to in that post was actually, if you just look at something like nature, and if you look at a lion leaping, like for the trophy, yeah, actually that's an incredibly vulnerable act, because the moment that it leaps and it stretches this way, all of its underbelly is now exposed. So there's incredible... let's say uncertainty and vulnerability in that act of courage. Mm-hmm. But those two things, I would argue, come together. So, you know, what I often help people to do when they kind of come to me for work in psychology is actually more about removing the armor. Mm. You know, the more we're able to experience uncertainty, the more free we become, you know, the more able we are to move. So there is a cool kind of redefining of, you know, what does great mental performance look like?
in terms of that conceptualizing, that high level understanding of ACT, about an episode or two before this one, I've kind of gone into that. So for anyone that's missed that, I would encourage them to go back and hear it. But I think acceptance and commitment, coaching or training in this context, requires us, encourages us, to gives a call to action to us to open the door to and be curious about feelings and emotions rather than run away from them. Here in the UK, for example, where we are sat today, and I don't like to get into stereotypes and generalizations, but the reality is that men especially have a track record of, for whatever reason, not really wanting to. They might acknowledge that a feeling is there. They might have even given it, at the very least, some cursory thought as to what it could mean. But to actually do deep work around those thoughts and feelings is quite uncomfortable. What's the benefit to a golfer in this case of doing this work?
I think it's a great question, and just maybe to kind of, you know, a couple of really like big values for me are humor and playfulness, right? So, like sometimes, particularly with college golfers, this lands well, but even just the average golfers, I ask people to check themselves for their STDs. Because we've all got them, right? We've all had them. We've all got them. But riddled with them. In this context, it stands for socially transmitted dogmas. So it's these ideas, it's these messages, it's these beliefs that just kind of, you know, get in through the water supply. Mm. And we just kind of, you know, pick them up as we go along, you know, very often innocently as we move through life.
Yeah.
And the biggest one in the performance space is, in order to play well, I must feel confident. Mm. And I'm not knocking on confidence. Like, confidence is a wonderful feeling when it's there. And when it's there, great, use it, okay? I'm not knocking on confidence. But when we get into this kind of relationship with, I can only play my golf when, right? Mm. Of course, what does it put you on the lookout for? Anything that's not that feeling. So now you're playing golf with eyes in the back of your head. Now you're looking to kind of reassure yourself when, you know, the last ball you hit on the driving range isn't quite the way you want it to. Oh, no, I need to go back. I'm going to go to the pro, get another 50 balls, right? Because you hit a bit of a squirrely one and then that feeling disappeared. So all of a sudden now you get tons and tons of behaviors. We'd call them avoidance moves, right? You get tons and tons of behaviors around, like, you know, grasping for that kind of feeling and trying to push away anything that's not that feeling. But of course, when you get to that ambiguity of the first tee and all of a sudden you realize that the next group has got there kind of before you, they're there early and you didn't expect that, now your prediction, you know, brain is like, whoa, hold on a second. I thought I was playing with the three guys that I'm really comfortable with, and I'm kind of confident playing with them. But now there's these four other guys, and one of these guys, like, you know, he was a bit of a douche to me the week before, right? So now it's like, now I've got all these eyeballs on me. Like, what do we do there? You see what I mean?
I do.
So it can narrow us down into a bit of a trap. And in terms of the work, I'd say is, you know, what happens with these STDs is, I call it the internal out of bounds. Mm. So we basically start placing, which is a golfer's worst nightmare, right?
You know,
nobody hates internal out of bounds more than me. It's just a, you know, a weird thing for a golf course. But we do this to ourselves. You know, certain feelings, certain thoughts, we literally place the white stakes around them. And of course, the more we do that, and you do that enough over time, you know, if you're looking out onto a golf course that's got a ton of internal out of bounds, you know, are those fairways looking narrower or are they looking wider?
Mm.
Right? Everything starts to shrink in. Everything gets more constricted.
Mm.
So a lot of the work that I do with clients, and sometimes I've actually been on the golf course with clients, and we've imagined where those out of bounds posts are, and our job, or the, you know, the client's job, has been to actually uproot them. It's like, no, we can have this feeling. Like, oh yeah, there's some doubt, you know, or there's some vulnerability, there's some uncertainty. And that uprooting process of starting to remove those internal out of bounds posts, you know, do the trees disappear? Do the hazards disappear? No, of course they don't. They're still there. Mm. But now the golf course is beginning to look like, oh, look at this. You know, the fairways get a bit wider. The targets get a little bit wider. You would think?
I am, yeah. I dare say that's very empowering as well when you work with someone in that way. And would I be right to hear this is a nice segue or tie to experiential avoidance, right? Feel free to go a bit deeper on that one because, you know, again, as I've defined it to my viewers and listeners before, my understanding of that is that as the clue's in the title, it's avoiding an experience. And so maybe you feel you're just giving examples of it there, but how does that, have you got any really compelling examples of, again, you know, you work with various clients and I'm sure there's client confidentiality, but have you got any anecdotes or anything that really touch on that one?
Yeah, and I think it's important to recognize like just how normal that is.
Yeah.
Right. Like we are psychologically, biologically, physiologically, we are wired, we are primed for avoidance.
Yeah.
So avoidance moves, like not all avoidance is bad, you know, like for instance, if I have the feeling of like really desperately needing the toilet, you know, I'm going to avoid that feeling by going guess where, right? So, you know, not all avoidance is necessarily bad in that sense. But when you have a situation, you know, like for instance, someone in a coffee shop having a panic attack, let's say, you know, the natural move is then to avoid that coffee shop. But then they have a panic attack in the supermarket, right? So they avoid that. Then they have a panic attack in, you know, driving the car somewhere. So then they, you know, avoid driving the car, but then they have a panic attack in the taxi. And can you feel how, like, the avoidance net, so to speak, it just shrinks people down and down and down and down and down until they can't leave the house.
Yeah.
Right? So you get that, the kind of the fear of even going outside. Mm-hmm. You know, no one starts out in that place. It's a gradual kind
it's
of
a tiny, snowball yes, effect. Yeah.
You got it. Yeah, so avoidance kind of begets more avoidance.
Yes.
And, you know, we could use some kind of golfing examples there of, you know, playing with certain people or, you know, certain golf holes, right? You have a bad experience with the 15th hole. And then all of a sudden it's like, I'm on the 13th hole and I can't stop thinking about that. Or I'm on the 18th hole and I'm still thinking about what happened on the 15th. So that avoidance spread kind of widens out. And I remember a client coming to me and, you know, this had been playing out for several years. And the only time he was able to play golf was at 5 o'clock in the morning in the summer. Like he was that's all he was comfortable with playing.
Okay, so this is a comfort thing rather than a schedule thing or whatever.
It wasn't a schedule thing.
What was it about the conditions at 5 a.m. in the morning that meant he?
No one else around.
Yeah.
Right. And if there was a greenkeeper buzzing by, like he would just pick up his ball, walk to the next hole. But there was the missing out on the richness of the social aspects, the friendships he had to kind of say goodbye to, the, you know, and really, you know, we retraced it. It's never one event, of course, but we retraced it to one kind of particular moment of embarrassment, essentially. And, you know, they gave him a nickname in the clubhouse and then slowly but surely, then it happened again. And, you know, all in the service of then not having that experience, right? So, you know, the world shrunk down, it shrunk down, it shrunk down. And then he found himself in this situation where he was playing at 5 a.m. He still loved the game, but he didn't love the context, right? So, we did a lot of work around opening up to embarrassment. That was the feeling. So, you know, he would see friends outside of golf, and part of that move towards actually removing some of the outbounds posts were things like this. It was like telling a joke and deliberately forgetting the punchline. Right? So he was exposing himself to these situations kind of in a much wider context.
Yeah.
And then slowly but surely it was like, oh, I can have this feeling, noticing the different features of
it.
Right. Oh, it feels like here, it's kind of in my tummy and it feels like this. And then my mind says this when this happens.
Yeah.
And, you know, the little kind of saying I've come up with is because we're exposing, essentially, we're getting back in touch with, we're deliberately walking into the places that your mind says are out of bounds, or your history says is out of bounds, you're deliberately walking there and then having a look around and removing some of the white stakes. And that was a real beautiful story of him beginning to kind of lean into like some of those feelings, some of those sensations that come with embarrassment, and kind of recognizing, you know, I remember asking him, like, have you ever died of embarrassment? And he was like,
we're still going, and as we actually got into this weird place
of really pursuing embarrassment rather than running away from embarrassment, you know, we started to get a little bit more, like, some playfulness showed up, some curiosity showed up, and you know, slowly but surely over the weeks and months, he got more and more back in touch with playing at different times of day and starting to kind of, and people saying, oh my god, John, you know, great to see you, like, I haven't seen you for years, you know, and starting to get back in touch with, like, friendships, and that was a real beautiful story of re-engaging and being on a much more of a values-based journey as opposed to an avoidance-based journey.
Glad you said the word values, because I'm going to come back to that in just a moment, because I'd like that to be the next place that we go. But I'll just share a brief word, you know, just, you know, my own experience, I think, of experiential avoidance in golf specifically. So that example you just gave makes me think about the journey I've been on since I first started GYH a little over 2 years ago. And my why for that, ultimately, or the thing that the life event that compelled me to start doing this and to act out my values, and one of my core values is to be of service to others, was the passing of my son. And as I've shared with you, Trev, you know, one of the very first thoughts that came to me in the hospital when we were there when he passed was, when I get out of here, the first place I want to get to is the golf course, because I know that golf is good for me. It does. That's my kind of relationship with golf, and in a sort of therapeutic sense, and in it for the last however many years. But a really curious thing, which I maybe hadn't labeled until now, was, you know, I talk a lot on my own podcast, or I've guested on other people's, and I tell that story, and how I was on someone else's podcast the other day, and he said, so Chris, what was it about playing golf on your own after you lost Innes? Why on your own? Why did you want to do that on your own? And I said, well, I just needed solitude. But what I needed, Trev, as well, was not, it was to avoid someone asking me, do you have kids? Or it was to avoid a certain situation. Now, if I heard you right a few minutes ago, you said something about some avoidance is good or some avoidance is okay. And I maintain that 2 and a bit years ago, that kind of avoidance in that moment was fine. That was what I needed for various reasons back then. But the really curious thing is that now you fast forward to, and a lot of water has passed under the bridge since then, not least including a spell on the board of directors at that same club that I used to be a member at and play at. I've got a lot of, probably need some act in my life to help me through that experience. But I have avoided that place for a while now, because I don't want to see certain people. I don't want them to ask me uncomfortable things about me, my son, and my family. It's like at that point in time, I would openly share and talk about my son. But then it was like, there came a point where I was like, I went in on myself a bit. And almost, I think, my takeaway from what you said is, speaking personally, as much as talking about these or facing up to these experiences can be uncomfortable, context is everything. Timing is important. But actually, I keep having to remind myself that let's bring this to a headline level in golf, especially as a recreational golfer. you can craft an experience for yourself in golf where you can make sure that the people that you surround yourself with, the people that are in your four ball, are friends of yours that you like. But there's always a risk, such as life, that someone's going to be a dick in the four ball, or someone's going to say something that you don't like, or say something that makes you feel uncomfortable, or, you know, they'll call penalty on you because you've teed it up in front of the yellow tee box. You know, it's stuff like that. So it's, I guess it strikes me that in golf, as in life, there are things out there ready to trip us up at a moment's notice, but almost by just by constantly being willing to work on those things, see them for what they are, and sort of it just takes a sting out of them, basically. So
there's a ton of banana skins out there.
Yeah.
Right. And obviously, I appreciate our conversation kind of prior to this regarding your son, and it reminds me of maybe one of the best things in psychology that I've ever heard, that in our pain we find our values, and in our values we find our pain.
Yeah,
you know, it says something about that willingness for you to lean into that, right? And to now be sat here, you know, openly discussing it, this being of you know, in the service of something really important to you, right? This this kind of around this contribution and this you know, golf yourself happy, and I think it's a tremendous kind of transformation, right, from something painful into something meaningful, and those two things being able to coexist. And that there's a weird piece of that, you know, coming back to that example of it, as you said, you know, playing with people you don't like, the banana skins that we inevitably face, and just how steadying and stabilizing our values can become. So it's like there's some really good data from about 20 years old onwards. What we care about, what's important to us, stays pretty stable across the course of our lives. And obviously we can be flexible with those things, but there's an interesting thing of like the more remote we are from our values, when we do hit those banana skins, which we're good, you know, just give it 5 minutes. If you feel all right now, just give it 5 minutes. It's gonna come. When we're very remote from our values, like when those banana skins are hit, then, you know, we're spun round. We're all at sea. We're really gonna, you know, struggle a lot more. So values can be incredibly rebalancing, really powerful. You know, there is a interesting kind of quote there. Around, like, if you stand for nothing, you fall for everything. And I think when I have amateur golfers, professional golfers kind of coming to me, you'd be amazing how many overlaps there are in terms of like a YouTube addiction to, you know, a swing fix or an idea or something that's just going to make, you know, something that's just going to guarantee some kind of outcome. And there's like a real remoteness from values. You know, like when I ask that question, like, what is this in the service of?
Do these people even know what their values are? I wanted to ask you how you actually...
Well, do you remember, do you remember back in primary school? Like, do you remember back in that class in primary school where, you know, everyone in the class was talking about their values? Do you remember that class? Oh, no way, it never happened. Right?
Sorry, I'm just looking at you like... did that class happen? Like, you're speaking about it as a matter of fact. I'm like, no, I don't.
There's that playfulness and humor value, right?
That's that banana skin so you're just talking about.
It's just not part of the cultural conversation.
No,
you know that this kind of you know, we get a very short time on the planet, right? And like, what do you want to be about in that time? Because very often when we get into this space of this very conditional relationship with performance, when it's just like going to that, and I get it, we don't have to not care about performance. We can absolutely care about performance. But when that's the only thing you're playing for, it's going to be a rough ride. So if we can really care about improvement, if we can really care about performance, and also, like, you know, make that distinction that the driving range is by really has so little in common with actually playing golf.
Yeah,
and I know everyone's heard that, but I sometimes use this kind of analogy of, you know, the driving range is a bit like Tesco car park on a Sunday evening, right? And playing golf is more like rush hour, you know, in wherever. So it's just asking such different questions, like outside of the car, inside of the car. So it's important to, you know, honor that distinction between those two. But if the only thing that you're there to do is to, you know, improve your handicap or to beat your friend or whatever it is, you know, whatever, you get that very conditional relationship with performance. And if anyone wants to get a feel for, okay, well, do I have that kind of relationship? Am I a little bit too kind of invested in this only one way? Very simple exercise I have people do is just ask your wife. Ask your wife. And then get her to, or husband, get them to show you your face on a bad day. And then that will tell you all you need to know.
Yeah, I don't need to ask. I've been told
before.
Yeah.
So like all of the eggs, let's say, in the performance, you know, it becomes very, very all or nothing. And it, in a strange kind of way, it creates that paradox of, you know, now you're playing with a gun to your head.
Yeah.
Right? Because if how I feel about myself is being determined by the number on a scorecard, and that's the only thing. And by the way, I've been there. Like, my God, have I been there in my playing career. And it made me miserable, right? And again, let's just nest this into this conversation. You know, in a weird way, there's a little bit of a performance happening. You know, I've got a lot of skill and knowledge and experience. Like, can I bring that out into this conversation?
Yeah.
But the way I feel about myself or the way I relate to myself, like once this conversation ends, if the only way that I get to feel good about myself is by delivering the best conversation the world has ever seen, like the best podcast, like just dropping gem after gem after gem, you see what I mean? If that doesn't happen, which by the way, I'm human, right?
Yeah.
And if that doesn't happen, then where does that leave me?
Yeah.
So the bizarre thing about values is it becomes this incredibly stabilizing and steadying reinforcer, right? That I can have my values with me here, right now. I can have my values with me after this conversation finishes. I can have my values with me as I go and play tournament golf this year, which I will. Yeah. So I think it's an important conversation that just, it doesn't happen enough in our culture.
I've just come out of a corporate environment that I've spent 11 years in, and I draw quite a lot of parallels between it and elite golf environments a lot of the time, which is it feels inherently serious to me. It feels like, I love, because when you were given that example about the STDs of the college athletes earlier, I mean, that must be severely disarming for them. But like at the same time, it's like, because it's so unusual, and it's just like, it's giving people permission to have a bit of a laugh about inherently, because these are fundamentally quite serious and philosophical subjects, right? But maybe an idea for us to sort of look at or work on together in the future, Trev, is, and I was wanting to tell you about this on the way over here today, is in that corporate career, right, I worked in HR and learning and development, and I saw every form of performance assessment and sort of diagnostic tool under the sun. And what you often find with them was they were all, it was all based on a system where you would basically go on online and you'd fill in a certain psychometric or something, and it would churn out this report, and it would use all this kind of like formulaic, had certain categories, it all by the very naming convention sounded very serious and corporate. And then we had a company that came in who used basically no form of like, you know, sort of a psychometric modeling or testing or anything. And they literally just had a one-to-one conversation with you. And they said, you know, it's like questions like, what do you care about? What do you love? And what they then presented you back with was a report which was your values in your own language read back to you. And I go back to that because, and this is why I ask you the question, like, do the golfers that you work with know what their values are? And it sounds like the answer is kind of no, because they don't remember that class and values in school because it never happened. And it's like, that's why I think ACT, again, and with being values-led is so powerful. I mean, to give an example that I just think of randomly now, it's like, if one of my values, me as Chris, is be of service to others, how does that play out in recreational golf? Help your mate look for it in the rough, for example, rather than being in your own game all the time. And I'm bad at that, by the way, Trev. Like, I've just creamed that down the middle, and I'm walking up to that ball thinking about how I'm going to nut the approach shot. Meanwhile, matey boy over there, who, bless him, is having a terrible round, he could probably do with my help right now and give him a... So, yeah.
And I think I come back to this idea of just, like, thank God for Scotty Scheffler.
Yes.
Because I think we've seen historically that this idea, which, by the way, wasn't actually really happening, but the idea from the commentators and from the... from the writers, from the journalists around Tiger Woods, was like, this is mental toughness. This is what's going to get you better at golf. This is the thing that we need to kind of just cut and paste, right? And then Scotty Scheffler comes along, and he reminds me of Usain Bolt in a way. You remember kind of like when Usain Bolt first came on the scene, and again, just it had been decade after decade of this tunnel vision, the seriousness of the sprinters on the blocks, you know, and it was all very much kind of like basically a war between them, trying to kind of, you know, psychologically outmuscle your opponent, intimidate your opponent. And then, they'd go along the line, right? And then Usain Bolt, as one of the fastest qualifiers or the fastest qualifier, would be in the middle lane. And all of a sudden he's like, hey, and like he's doing his hair and he's dancing and he's smiling. Yeah. And, his competition didn't know what to do with that. They were just like, I'm trying to be here being all macho. And this guy's just, so these values, and I'm seeing a lot of that with Scotty Scheffler around just how values-led he is, and witnessing like just how stable. And this guy is going to suffer. Okay, he's on a heater, and he has been for a while now, but there will come a point where, he'll lose a parent, someone will get ill, his form will suffer,
suffered, though, Trey. Remember the Ryder Cup, when he got beat 9-7 or something?
Yeah, yeah.
I love that. I mean, the man's, he knew all the eyes of the world were going to be on him then, and he's crying his eyes out in the back of a cart.
Yeah, and absolutely. And this last Ryder Cup, if he hadn't won his singles match, I think it would have been the worst record in Ryder Cup history because he would have been 5-0.
Yeah.
But beyond that, this is a guy who cares deeply. Like, one of his values is competition, right? So it's not like we're stripping out, courage and competition and things like that. No, that can be a value. I remember winning a tournament 2 years ago, and I think a value that I had in my back pocket was competitiveness, And I remember that day just being like locked in, So they don't have to be, these kind of like fluffy, airy-fairy things. They can be, as I said, just incredibly robust and stabilizing. But they are, they give us so much more than just the number on the scorecard. Mm. And what I've just witnessed time and time again with the clients that I've worked with at every level of the game, including amateur golfers who just want to get better at golf, is as we start to kind of add that ingredient, as we add that into the mix, their enjoyment of the game goes up, the ability to spend the weekend with their wife and not be off in their head trying to solve their backswing, right? Mm. To actually show up at dinner with their wife and, the number of times that, they thank me on behalf of their wife, right, for the work that we're doing.
Yeah, yeah.
And in a weird way, actually,
part of the service.
It's all part of the service. Yeah. In a weird way, the kind of the extension, and this is a place that I've, again, never realized that I'd ended up having some expertise in, but is actually in the Yips. And there is, people that are struggling with the Yips are so problem saturated. It's kind of like, it's the problem, it's the solution. It like the whole world is performance, basically.
Most golfers will have, at least in passing, heard the term the Yips, but how's it actually defined?
I think a nice easy way to think about it would be almost like a physical stutter, okay. a movement stutter,
yeah.
Right?
Gotcha.
And again, it puts people's hair on fire. And again, everyone has their own individual context as to
yep.
kind of, you know, what produces yeah. it, what sustains it. But very often there's a remoteness from values because it's me and the problem and it's solving the problem and that's it. Internal out of bounds posts all over the place. You know, anything that's even remotely close to not being perfect execution. A lot of identity gets wrapped up in, you know, I call it obsession with the brand. Almost like I have to keep up appearances. I have to look in a certain way.
Obsession with the brand, I like that.
Yeah, so values becomes, you know, a really nice movement towards freedom, a really nice movement towards something that kind of transcends just you and the struggle, and you're in a dark room and there's nothing else in the world. It starts to kind of, you know, the curtains start to open, we start to kind of let a bit of fresh air in, open the windows, and it's like, oh, I get to be about more than, if I could say it this way, you know, when I'm sat with the client who's really struggling, especially with something like the Yips, you know, I want them to be more than just a life support machine for this struggle, because that's what they end up being, you know. And I'm like, yeah, you get to be about something else. You get to be about.
I heard you talking on Carl Morris's Mind Caddy podcast recently. You shared a story there about working with a client in which you said to him, "I'm not here to help you feel better. I'm here to help you be better at feeling."
Mm.
Can you please expand on that?
You've stolen the punchline, right? But
yeah, exactly.
He was a fellow countryman, yeah. you know, yeah. For you. So
it was, material, not yeah, mine, yeah. by the way. I'm just, it's context setting. I'm not trying to be that guy.
But this was, so it was the captain of Scotland at the time.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was one of my biggest clients at that time that I was just sat with in like a first session. And I'd done some work with some of his colleagues and that had gone really well. So of course, you know, being, you know, these kind of quite close knit groups, you know, why is so-and-so playing? Like, what's going on there? You know, we tend to be quite curious about upticks in performance, of course. Word gets around. So I'm sat there with the captain of Scotland at the time and he's happy for me to share this story. And basically we kind of sat down and he'd been struggling with his putting and was kind of like experienced a lot of anxiousness, you know, and this guy is, you know, multiple national champion, you know, across different countries, French Open champion, Italian Open champion, has done well in the States, yada, yada, yada. And he was really struggling with putting, a lot of kind of anxiety around putting and basically wanted, you know, Trev, you're the confidence guy, you're the sports psychologist, you know, come and help me out with this. And I remember looking him square in the eyes and I said, I'm not here to help you feel better. And he literally got, he got to get out of his chair and walk off because he was like, what the hell do you mean? Like, Trev, you're the hot shot kind of performance side.
Like, had you set it up in a way you're like, I know he's going to react to like this. I'm doing, like, did you sort of lead with it, wait, see his reaction and like, sit back down.
Yeah,
I'm here. Do you get what I mean?
Yeah, just waited for him to kind of come back and just this look of perplexed curiosity.
Yeah.
And then I kind of clarified, you know, I'm not here to help you feel better. I'm here to help you get better at feeling.
Mm.
And in the weirdest way, that this removal of the internal out of bounds, like this ability to feel what you feel with integrity. Yeah. Like, when did you first hear, like, who told you that you weren't allowed to feel what you feel? Right? I'm asking, like, a credible question for someone working in psychology.
Yeah.
Like, where did you first learn that it wasn't okay to feel what you feel? And maybe just asking that as a bit of a, you know, throwing that question out there, like, I think is an important one, because we get these kind of, we pick up these STDs super young, right? Boys don't cry, you know, all of this stuff.
Yep.
And I get that. There's a time and a place. I'm not necessarily going to be, you know, weeping in Costa, although I have, right? But, you know, life happens.
Yeah, of course.
But, you know, there are times and places for these things to happen. But just this general sense of, I think particularly in the UK, an American psychologist once pointed out to me, like you guys in the UK, you really struggle with logic, you know, because it's all very, you know, logical and stoic and rational. And, you know, we've got a long heritage of that kind of way of being. And that really struck me. I was like, wow, yeah, like culturally we do. But I also want to like float another equation out there. And I know this is going to, this could hit hard, okay? But I do want to throw this out there, is that we're really trained up to not feel what we feel, okay? Mm-hmm. To suppress, control, avoid. Mum's the word. Like, we don't speak about stuff. And I also want to point something else out. What is the biggest killer of men in the UK in their 40s?
Suicide.
So how is that going? And I know it's a complex topic. I know that there are tons of kind of angles there, but I just want to say a part of that mix is we're trained up, and athletes are no different. Sports people, golfers are no different. When it gets this very one-dimensional, it's got to be this way. I can only perform when, you know, now we're setting ourselves up to basically say, well, actually, I can only drive my car when it's sunny and 20 degrees outside, right?
Yeah.
So we get into these very narrow bandwidths, and it's not great for living, and it sure as hell isn't great for performing.
This was our first, but I sincerely hope this is not our last conversation and interaction.
Yeah.
Because genuinely, I think with what I'm building, I think, you know, I hope maybe that as my community grows, you would consider coming and speaking to the community at some time. And
100%.
And yeah.
Chris, it's been awesome.
Good man. Thanks.
Great seeing you, man.
So there we have it, a really powerful conversation, and one that I think challenges a lot of what we've been taught to believe about golf and performance more broadly. This idea that we need to feel confident, in control, and ready before we can play well, when in reality, the game doesn't work like that. If anything, this episode is a reminder to you that you don't need to fix your thoughts, you don't need to eliminate frustration, you just need a different relationship with them. And when you start to shift that, the whole experience of golf begins to change. If this episode resonated with you, if you recognized yourself in any of this, then I'd really encourage you to come and join us inside the Happy Hackers Club. It's a free WhatsApp community for everyday golfers where we are trying to build a healthier, more enjoyable relationship with the game. With no pressure, no ego, no pretending you've got it all figured out. Just real people sharing the reality of golf. You can join us via the link in the show notes. Please do come and be a part of it. Thank you for listening. I'll see you in the next one. And remember, folks, happiness first, handicap later.